Let me introduce our main speaker, Michelle from Escondido.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Michelle, and I am an alcoholic. And I'd like to welcome the newcomers here tonight. You're in the right place. And I'd like to also congratulate all the token takers. What a wonderful milestone. Looks like you have a lot of years racked up in this room tonight. I'm going to share what it was, what happened, what it was, and what it is like now. And I'd also like to start off with my sobriety date is April the 3rd, 2009. I do have a sponsor. My sponsor has a sponsor, and that sponsor has a sponsor, and I know who they are. And yeah, really important. And my home group is the Tuesday night speaker meeting at 7:30 in Escondido. My story does start off that I do come from a family of alcohol, and there was alcoholism all over the place on both sides of the family. I was born in Los Angeles in the old General Hospital. If anybody's from LA, you'll know exactly where that's at. I was raised in East Los Angeles. My father met my mother in Los Angeles. My father's from New York, the Bronx, and he's Puerto Rican, and my mother is Mexican, and she was raised in Salinas. So they met in Los Angeles, and from there it was history. They had a family. Growing up, I'm the middle child. There's eight of us. And I always felt different from my brothers and sisters. They kind of shunned me. They didn't want to play with me. I was just too into books. I was self-taught growing up. By the time I got to kindergarten, I knew how to read. I could pick up a book. My first books were Dr. Seuss books and the children's Bibles. I really, really loved. That's where I felt like I had a connection with a God. Although my family was not, we didn't go to church. You know, we were just that family that just didn't go to church. So, but I always felt a connection with God only because my brothers and sisters didn't want to play with me. I was the middle child. The older ones went with their friends, and the young ones, well, they were just a little too young. And so I spent a lot of time by myself. And family gatherings, we would get together at my grandmother's house on the weekends. And my mother is from a family of 13. So when we would get together at grandma's house, she had this big backyard and it looked like a playground for children. And it was just us. And my family would feed the kids first. She had this big table. And we would eat first. She'd make us go wash our hands and go out in the back. And then the adults would eat. And then after the adults would eat, the beer would come out. And so they would start to drink. And then it was just on from that time on. On my grandfather's side, they drank as well, but they drank the Puerto Rican rum. And so it was really interesting being brought up with two different types of cultures. They're just too different, both sides. Anyway, as I grew up, as a young child, and I shared this before, that my father, he worked sometimes 2 to 3 jobs, and he wanted to have a home for his children, and they bought a brand new home in El Sereno. And the boys had their room, the girls had their room, my parents had their room. And one day I was in my mother's closet, my mother and father's closet, and my mother had this beautiful green chiffon dress that she wore on New Year's. And I remember playing in her closet and, you know, playing dress up, putting the shoes on and filling out that nice chiffon dress. And I found a shoebox. And like I said, my dad had 2 or 3 jobs. I used to think sometimes he was a milkman because sometimes he'd come home in a uniform, a white uniform, but he worked down at the docks over in Los Angeles, and he would bring home cases of, you know, vegetables and fruit for us. My mother was a country girl, so we weren't raised on candy and soda and chips. I mean, it was, my fruit was a green pepper or a tomato. You know, that's just the way we were growing up. And then getting back to the closet, I got this box and I opened it. It was a shoebox. But inside that shoebox, there was this green brick or something square. And it was fitted inside this shoebox. And I thought it was a present for me because I'm so self-centered. And I went to my mom and I said, "Mom, is this a gift for me?" And she just looked at me kind of strange. And when she opened it up, she saw what it was. And obviously, it was a brick of weed. I guess that was my father's third job. You know, I don't know. One of his jobs. And so for some reason, after that, the family seemed to have split. And there were so many of us. Some of us went with Dad. Some of us went with my mother to Grandma's house. And we stayed. I knew I was the one that stayed behind with my dad. And so my dad, in order to keep the mortgage going and stuff, he had this great idea, you know, that he is going to get a paper route. And he got all of us kids together, and he would make us roll up those papers and put the rubber bands and stack them, because he would bring them, you know, go out 4 o'clock in the morning and bring them. By the time before we went to school, we had to make the piles for the kids and to come on their bikes to load up their the papers. And when we would run out of rubber bands, he taught us how to fold it in a certain way so that it wouldn't open up. And then my father had a Volkswagen, one of those old Volkswagen vans. And so he took out the seats in the middle. We would stack all the paper in there, and we would go on the paper route with my father. My brother had his bike, so he had his route. We were the girls. We were in there. And I always remember my father had his friend Richard with him. And they always had a bottle stuck between their legs of booze, you know. And my father was so good at this that we would hand them the papers, and he would just go out the window and just throw it out, and it would land up in your lawn. And we just kept going, and that's how it was. Or we had the door open in the middle, and then we would just flip them out like that. And so that's how we were. My dad utilized us all, the kids. And as I was growing older, it was really pretty hard because all of us were separated. My brothers and sisters were all separated, and when we got to see each other, it was really a really precious moment because my father was the kind of father that he didn't believe in friends, you know, and he built this wall on one side of the house next to a field that we lived when they first bought it, because it was brand new, and it was the cedar blocks, and on the other side, he had a chain link fence. And in the front, he planted some beautiful dicandra. And when we would get in trouble, he'd make us go outside and pull weeds in the front. So it was beautiful grass. And then we asked him, "Hey, Dad, why can't we have friends?" And he said, "Oh, friends, huh?" He lined us all up like this. He says, "Take a good look around you." He goes, "These are your friends." And that's just the way it was in his house. You know, we didn't have friends. They didn't come over. We didn't have sleepovers. That was it, school and back. And your brothers and sisters are your friends. And I thank my father to this day for that, because we are very close. As far as family first. I grew up and I just never felt a part of anything. When I would go to school, I would sit in class and my head was not in the here and now. It was just out there. I was thinking about the chaos at home. I was thinking about all kinds of things, but I was never in the here and now, present in the room, the classroom. And, you know, it was really interesting because I never studied. But when I took a test, I always got A's. And so that was another thing my brothers and sisters would hold against me. "Oh, who does she think she is? You know, she's the A student." My parents, it seems like they just made it more injurious for me because they didn't like me for being a straight A student. So I felt, growing up, being a straight-A student wasn't going to make it. Although that was my passion. I really did love school. So I started getting in trouble in school. My dad, when it was all said and done, the dust settled, and the kids were where they were supposed to be, I ended up living with my father and my stepmom, and I called myself Cinderella because everything that had to be done, I had to do it. Now, my dad was the kind of dad that boyfriends weren't allowed or anything like that, and The way he dressed me like an old lady at 13 years old. And I am not kidding. When you're wearing hot pants in the 70s, not in my dad's house, or tight pants or jeans or Levi's, he had me wearing, when the girls were wearing mini skirts, he had me wear dresses an inch below my knee with knee highs and penny loafers and just sweaters, you know what I mean? So I used to go to school, and I used to feel so out of sorts, and I used to go to my locker early in the morning, and I had a pair of Levi's in there, some hush puppies or moccasins, and a cute little top, and I'd go straight to school, and I'd change before everybody got to school, and then I fit in. And so that's just how it was living with Dad, you know. And as I grew up, I started to experiment. Now, my drinking career did not start till I was about 35, 36 years old. And let me tell you something, the women are the real deal. You know, we go down quick. I don't know why, maybe because all the kids I had, I have no clue. But when I started experimenting, in the dry goods. And the reason why I say this is because one time, when my mother was out of control and she was drinking, we would be at my grandmother's house, and the bars were just like a block away from where my grandmother lived. And so when they started drinking on Friday night, it didn't stop to maybe Sunday night. And there were times we were left alone, and we had to go look for my mother in the bars. And we used to tell her, you know, Mom, you know, when are we going to go home? Or, Mom, we're hungry. And she would be sitting on a bar stool. And back in the day, back there in the 60s and 70s, a kid can go into the bars, and it wasn't really frowned on. You know, you weren't there to drink. You were just there to go pull your parent out of the bar. And so one day we couldn't find my mother, and we were at my grandmother's house. I said, man, what the heck? Where did Mom go? She just did a Houdini on us. And as I was passing to go to the bathroom, there's this closet that didn't have a door anymore, but it had like a cloth that would, you know, you could pull across that closet. And I smelled something really bad, really bad. And I opened it up, and there was my mother. She just did not make it to the bathroom, and she's just moaning in a blackout. And I remember shutting that thing, and I said, dear God, I hope I never wake up to be someone like her. You know, it was just so disgusting, and I was full of shame, and I was embarrassed for her. And that was just an incident that I realized that when I grew up, I wasn't going to be an alcoholic like my family. I didn't want to drink like my family. I was going to be different from my family. And moving fast forward as a young, I got in a lot of trouble. By the way, my dad caught me one day. He was walking into the school, and they said, hey, your dad's coming. And I'm standing there with my Levi's and my hush puppies and everything. And here comes my dad, you know, because he thinks he owns the place, you know, and he's walking in with his suit looking like this, you know, slick and everything. And I'm like, hey, hi, Dad, you know. And, you know, he didn't say nothing to me. It was quiet. It was just never brought up again, but I think he knew how uncomfortable I felt in my own skin, and I didn't get punished for that for some odd reason, but I did get in trouble in that school a lot, and that was in junior high, and you know, those stories can go on, but as I made it out into the high school, I just got bored of high school. I didn't like being around with the young people. They were too young. I liked hanging out with the older guys, you know, so I used to check in, and then I used to just check out, and then I just hop in the car, and off we were off. We were gone, and, you know, party. And that's all it was. And so I would show up for school, go party, and then come back to school and just go home like nothing was going on. Show up once in a while for class, take a test, and just go. And I remember one time a counselor came up to me and says, you know, you have so much potential. How many times everybody in these rooms I've heard that you have so much potential. If you would just suit up and show up and be in class. And it just went over my head. And so when my experimenting with dry goods was over, I had made this decision And I thought, you know, my life needs to change. You know, I need something. And so what I did is I thought, there it is. I'm going to go to church. And so I was a really good, strong member in church. And I really loved it. Sincerely, I really did. And I was doing really good. And that's where I met my husband. And we got married. And we had our children. And then things just started to happen. When I was in church, and I went all the time, it just felt like something inside me just kept coming up. Like, whatever it was that was from my past, it kept coming up. And I always tell everybody, I feel like I was just doing a fifth step all my life, because anybody that would just give me a bending ear, I just had to just tell them my woes. And then they would say, oh, it's okay, well, let's just pray for you, and everything will be good. And it was just like someone just slapping a Band-Aid on it, and then it was just oozing out later. Whatever it was, I didn't know, because I didn't have a program for recovery. I didn't know about Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't know about any other of those programs out there. And if I did, it didn't mean nothing to me. I was pretty active in our church for, I would say, for about 11 years or so. And sober, not drinking, guess what happened? I landed up in a mental institution. Oh, yeah. And I just snapped. I just went bonkers. And they put me in there, and they gave me some really strong medicine. I don't even know the name of it. It starts with a T. All I just know is that I was just land up with my face and my food in the morning. And then I felt like I was 10-second Bob, because they would tell me something and I would forget. They would have us do arts and crafts and I would forget. Then I just said, you know, I can't take this stuff, because at nighttime I couldn't sleep. So those girls in there, they've been through there a couple of times. They would say, just go up there and just tell her you can't sleep. The medicine they gave you doesn't work. And I did that one time, and I couldn't wake up, and I wasn't like in la-la land for the whole rest of the day, so I wasn't going to do that again. And I told the psychiatrist, you know, I need to go home to my kids. You know, I really need to be home with my children. And so when I came in with my children, I just was just done. I was done being Susie Homemaker, you know, and being the housewife and cooking and watching four kids. All my kids are like 2 years apart, so do the math. And what happened was I had a neighbor, and she went to Mexico with her boyfriend. And she asked me one time to watch her five kids. So now I got nine kids to watch. And I said, yeah, I'll do that. As you know, and the kids liked me, and they played with my kids. And she came back, and she goes, I brought a present for you. And I go, well, what's that? She goes, I brought you a big bottle of Presidente. And I go, I don't drink. And she goes, yeah. Well, I said, okay, I'll put it up over here like a souvenir on the wall, you know, and everything else. And then, you know, it gets really stressful, you being a mom and watching one in the belly, one's in diapers, one's walking, and one's barely getting into preschool. It just was like, I was neurotic. So what happened one night, I was over at her house, and she says, well, let me just, you know, why don't we just open up that bottle of Presidente? And I said, well, I don't drink. She goes, yeah, but just take a little bit. And I said, well, okay. And so she put the glass right there in front of me. She put the ice. And then she says, and I'm going to put some Coke in there for you. You know, the kind that you drink, not the kind that the kind that you drink. And then she said, she was pouring the whiskey, whatever it is, brandy, I don't know what it is. And she put the Coke, and then and she stirred it, and I took a sip of it. I go, you know, this stuff tastes not nasty. And she says, I'm going to put a little bit more Coke in there for you so you can drink it. And as I went, I said, okay, and I drank it. You know, because that first little sip did something in my nostrils. It did something in here. And I said, okay, maybe it might make me feel a little bit more better if she put a little bit more of Coke in there. So I took a sip, a good long sip. And I remember, and I go, oh, that's what it was. And I felt this kind of like this stuff come up my nose, and my eyes went like this. It went down my throat, went through my chest, went down my arms, it came back up and went out my brains, it seemed like. And I go, oh, man. That's some good stuff. And, you know, and she made me, I go, give me another one of those. And I went home that night. I slept so good. Everybody was wonderful. I said goodnight to my husband, and I love you, and the kids, put them to bed, and everything was good. And I just slept, and I'm like, man, I like this stuff. And so a couple of days later, I said, hey, where's that bottle? And she says, I got it right here. You know, we polished off that bottle in about a week. And between her and I mean, two drinks here, and then I was just like feeling really good every day going home. And then before you know it, I had my bottle. And she says, well, let's go get your bottle. And I go, like, I'm going to save it for a souvenir. Lie. I saved it for myself. And so that started my drinking career. And I went into the institution already. I started my drinking. And because of my drinking, I went back to work, by the way. And I continued to drink. And I was drinking with coworkers. And, you know, El Torito was next door, so we used to go to happy hour. And before you know it, we were falling in bushes. But we would just have, it was only a few, you know, not too far away, about 100 feet away from where we lived. And my husband was a normie. He was a normie. And I tried to stop. He wasn't a drinker. I mean, just a glass of wine here and there. And he would leave the other half a glass of wine, and that was it for him. And I didn't let it go to waste. I would just drink it. And I didn't realize my alcoholism was starting to progress. I didn't see that. And I would say, I worked hard today. I need a drink, you know. Go to Trader Joe's, get whatever you need to get. He would buy my booze for me, not thinking that this thing is, I mean, we just opened up a Pandora's box here now. And it turned out to be that I saw I was drinking a little bit too much. So I kind of tapered off. But when I tapered off, I noticed my personality would just switch over, and I was just like on edge a lot. And I remember him going out and buying me a bottle of wine. He says, please drink. He asked me to please drink. And I just started drinking. Well, that marriage did end. Unfortunately, my children were caught in the crossfire. That dragged on for a long time. But the good news is that I ended up having, for some reason, I had custody of my children. But that didn't stop me from drinking. Not the love of my children, not the ex-husband. He was a good father and a good guy, but he didn't drink like I did, and it was starting to bother him. But I always showed up for work. I never missed work. Now, I would go to work drunk in the morning because the kind of work I do is I do a lot of different personalities, so I would come home thinking I'm going to justify drinking. So I would go home, take off I call it my monkey suit, but we had to dress in suits every day. And I'd take that off, and the first thing I would do is just take a drink. Nothing else. I didn't check on the kids. I didn't do anything. I just had to have a drink. I was one of the alcoholics that did not drink during business hours. Although I kind of call myself the Chapter 3 alcoholic, but that was one thing I did not do. I kind of prided myself on that one. But to be honest with you, I drank to oblivion every day. I drank till I passed out or blacked out. And I would wake up a lot of times drunk in the morning. So I would get to work, and I was still drunk. And nobody would tell me anything because I was the boss. So I kind of justified a lot of this stuff. I worked hard. I'm the boss. You can't tell me what to do. I'd go lock myself in my office. You'd open the door. You could smell the booze. You know how that smell it's in when you lock an alcoholic in an office? You could smell the booze. And nobody ever said anything. I mean, I was the kind of boss that would take my staff out to happy hour. And I would tell them, if you're going to drink all night, you're going to get drunk. You need to show up to work. I don't care if you're kissing that porcelain throne, but you're going to show up. And a lot of them came in hungover, and I said, I don't want to hear it. I'm here. But see, they didn't drink like I did. They tried to keep up with me, and then I started to realize, oh, wait a minute. You know what? They don't drink like I do. And so that started me off on my isolating drinking. I used to isolate. So they didn't get to see that part of me. But I do know that I show up, and then in the afternoon, around 11:30, 10 or 11 o'clock, I would say to myself, I started feeling my mood start to change. I guess maybe because The alcohol was leaving my body, and coffee wasn't working anymore. So I thought, well, maybe I'm hungry. So I'd say, go get something to eat. Buy burritos for everybody. That's what I need to do. I need to eat. That's what I need to do. I didn't know that my body's saying you need a drink, you know. And so I would eat. I would be fine. And then 3 o'clock, all of a sudden, I woke up. I was elated. Oh, man, it was just like, what happened to her? Her personality changed. And you know why? It's because I knew in a couple of hours I was going to get a drink. I knew it. And I was looking forward to that drink because everything I did evolved around my drinking. So that progressed for a long time, and it continued. A lot of incidents happened in between. But I don't want to stay on that any longer. I want to get sober. So I had a friend that came down. We used to party a lot, and he had surgery on his neck. And I said, well, why don't you just come on over and convalesce at my house? You know, keep me company. Because by that time, I was an isolated drinker. I wouldn't go out anymore to drink. I didn't go drink with anyone else. I would go to different liquor stores. I would go to the Chevron gas station. I would go to Trader Joe's one day. I would go to that liquor store over there, and I'd go to the grocery store. I'd go to Costco so that they wouldn't see that, you know. But what they would see in my basket, people made remarks like, oh, you're going to have a party? And I'm like, yeah. It was for me only. It was just my stuff. And so I invited him over, and I got really drunk one night, really, really bad. And I was in the streets hollering at 2:30 in the morning, waking up all the neighbors. And he pulled me in the house, and he says, you need to get quiet. He goes, calm down. So when I woke up the next morning, I said, hey, Joe, I said, you're my friend. We partied for a long time. We've gone through a lot. You know me really well. And can I ask you a question? He says, what's the question? I said, I want your honest answer, and I'm not going to get mad at you. He knew my temperament already, so he goes, okay. I said, Joe, am I an alcoholic? And he says, he paused, and then he said, yes, you are. I said, okay. So after he left, I sat out. I didn't do anything. I didn't take an action, but I would sit outside all the time with my pack of cigarettes, and I would have my drink, and I had a small little Bristo, and I would sit out there, and it got to the point where I started to cry alone, drinking by myself at night and drunk dialing people. That's with my cell phone, my drink, my cigarettes. And that got old. So one day I thought, you know what? I just started feeling this weirdness coming around, and I thought, you know, maybe I'm going to go check out an AA meeting. So what I did instead of going to check out a meeting, I have a relative that is in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous that lives in Palm Springs and been sober for a while. And maybe about 15 years prior to me making this visit I'm going to talk to you about, my sister and I presented her it was at City Hall. She wanted us to give her her token and cake. They don't give a cake. It's a styrofoam thing. And because they're not allowed to have candles and stuff like that in this the Civic Center. And we presented that to her, and we went out after that to Morongo and got drunk, real drunk. So we made it in like about 4 o'clock in the morning to my aunt's house, and she was not a happy camper, but she didn't say anything. And so she asked us, she goes, would you like to come with me to a meeting? And me and my sister kind of looked at each other, really a lot of guilt, and I was like, sure. And that was my first AA meeting. She took us to an AA meeting, and everybody knew us there. I didn't know who they were, but they knew who we were, and they, oh, you're the nieces. And I'm like, okay, she's saving a seat for us. I can say that now, but I didn't know that back then. And everybody was so kind to us. We had coffee, and we had donuts, and I said, that's a neat little place to go to. So fast forward now to where I'm about to tell you. The first meeting that I went to after that, I went to the Alano Club in Oceanside on a Sunday, and I got dressed up because I don't know anything. what the attire is to go to these meetings. And I sat down and I walked into the Alano Club, and they have this big bingo room over here, and they have guys flipping burgers over here, and they got restrooms in this other door to go somewhere else. And as I walk in, the guy that's flipping the burgers goes, he just went like that. He just pointed his finger, and I thought, okay, he knows what I'm here for. And so I walked in, I sat down, and to be honest with you guys, my head tell me, I don't belong here. I don't belong here. You know, I thanked everybody, and I left. And then about 2 weeks later, I showed up again at a different meeting, a women's meeting. And this was back in 2008. And I was just visiting you guys. I didn't get a sponsor. I didn't know what the steps were. The steps were very foreign to me. I had no clue what the steps, let alone traditions. And so I sat and I went to a couple of meetings, took some numbers, and I started drinking again. And what happened, I called this one lady, and she didn't answer my phone call. I left her a message, but I was drunk. You know, I realize that now, but not then. And so what I did is that she never got back to me. And I'm like, okay, these people shouldn't give out their phone numbers. So I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous again, a women's meeting. It was as Bill Seaton, Living Sober. And there was this lady that she was taking a 27-year token and a cake. And when the end of the meeting was there, they said, does anybody have any AA announcements? And there went my hand. They said, okay, well, what do you have to say? And I said, if you don't want anybody to call you like you say, don't give out your phone number. You know? And they were like, oh, shoot, you know? And so they all gathered around. We all did the serenity prayer, and I'm standing there like this, like, okay, I told them. They all congratulated this wonderful lady that was taking 27 years, and I could hear them, you go talk to her, Gail. You go talk to her. No, you go talk to her. You go talk to her. And so here she comes, and she comes out with her hand shaking like this. I feel so bad. And she walks up to me, and she goes, hi, my name is Gail. She's really soft-spoken. Here's my card, and you can call me. And I looked at her, and I said, you're going to call me? And I grabbed the card out of her hand. She goes, yeah, and it has my cell phone number, my work number, and my home number. I'm like, okay. So she goes, and I'd like to invite you to a big book study this upcoming Thursday. And I said, okay. And so what I did is I didn't call her. That was in the evening. I didn't call her Wednesday. Thursday came for that big book study, but I had a different idea. See, my alcoholism is, my head's out to get me because I don't have a program of recovery. So what am I going to do? And at that time, I wasn't working. So my best thinking says, why don't you just go market yourself? Go to that big gala they're having up there in Orange County. Go up there, and you know all those people there. You're in the industry with them, and I'm pretty sure you can get a job. Guys, it kind of sounds like, whose story was it? Bill's, Jim's story? And so there I went, and I heard this little voice say, I think you need to call that lady. And I'm like, no, I don't need to call that lady. I'm driving up to Orange County. And all day I was preparing myself to go up there, getting ready. I really didn't eat very much because during my disease, I didn't eat a lot as well. And so when I got up there, I ate, and the vendors, they have, it's open bar. You know, open bar for an alcoholic, man. Jeez, what a big deal for me. Long story short, I couldn't drive my car, so they drove my car to one of the vendors' places. We were really good friends. And we cracked open a bottle of Jack, and then it was the worst blackout, the worst drunk of all drunks I've ever experienced in my entire life. Now, I wasn't thinking of Alcoholics Anonymous, but let me tell you, I never got that drunk in my entire life. At least I thought so. I mean, for what it was bad. When When you say you see two people, I saw three people. And I had this idea that I'm going to jump in my car and I'm going to drive from Glendale, California to San Diego. Yeah, what a drive. And it's a long drive. And I got in my car and this person lived in Glendale on those little tiny streets that wind like this. And I'm going like this and I'm looking out of one eyeball and I see two. And a little voice said, I think you better turn around. This time I heard the voice, and I said, I think I better turn around. So I went back, and I slept it off a little bit. When I woke up in the morning, I drove about 4 or 5 o'clock home to San Diego. I was still drunk, but not as drunk where I was seeing three. I just only saw one and a half. So what happened, I just turned around, and I climbed my, got up in the morning, went to the DMV, I lost my wallet, called my credit cards, and I called that lady. And I said, you know, hey, you know, I told her what happened. And she says, you know, meet me at a meeting. And then that's what I did. I met her at the meeting. I went ahead and I sat down. I sat in the back row just to, you know, and I cried. That's all I can do is cry. I wore sunglasses and ball cap because all I could do was just, the pain was so bad. And then all of a sudden, I started to understand what the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous talks about, that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. That's what I felt like underneath my shoes. It was worse than the dirt beneath my feet. And then I also felt as well that the four horsemen were there. And that's what it was. It just came so surreal, you know, the fear, the terror, fear, the frustration, despair, and bewilderment. It was just there, and I didn't know what was wrong with me. I didn't go to a detox. They tell you not to detox on your own, but I didn't know what detox was, and I was shaking all the time in meetings. But you know what? I called that lady, and she started working with me in the steps, and, you know, she is my sponsor to this day, by the way. I mean, I stuck with her like glue. And she walked me through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. She spoon-fed me Alcoholics Anonymous. She took her time because my head was so much in the fog. And you know what? She got me to get into service, which I love. I love service. I love being a service. And she got me into cleaning the women's bathroom, stacking the chairs, making the coffee in different meetings. When she said 90 meetings, 90 days, I went to 3 or 4 meetings a day. I was just amazed by the stories that you had shared, and I find that, you know what? I think I found my people. It wasn't in church, you know. It wasn't out there in the streets, in the bars, or anything. It was right here, right now, that I could identify. I was able to identify, and that's why I knew I was in the right place of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I got busy in Alcoholics Anonymous. The beautiful thing about it is that I start to get my life back, a life that I felt I had a really full life. I never thought I'd get it back, but because of Alcoholics Anonymous, I was able to get it back. And when they talk about the family afterward, I got that back too. You know, I just had a trip with my family. My husband, myself, my four daughters, and my grandchildren, we all went on a road trip. And it was the 2-week road trip. And you know, no complaints whatsoever. None whatsoever. And Christmas Eve, we did the Puerto Rican dinner, traditional. And then on Christmas Day, we did Mexican dinner. We made tamales and stuff. So it was like my kids were used to that culture during the holidays. And the beautiful thing about it is that it just, what a miracle. Only because I came into these rooms, I surrendered. Because King Alcohol sure had its grips on me. I didn't have a grip on alcohol. It had its grips on me. And I was able to understand the steps. I was able to understand the 12 traditions and how they work for the group as well. And being a service, that was the most, to me, one alcoholic talking to another alcoholic. You know, there's just magic in there. It's just amazing that the meeting before the meeting, the meeting after the meeting, you get to talk to somebody. You have no clue who they are. You never met them, but all of a sudden you connect. Because we're here for, you know, a reason. All of us are here for that primary purpose. And I just kind of looked at it like I'm so grateful every morning. I get up and I get on my knees And I thank God for another day of sobriety. I thank God for my AA family. I pray for my AA family every morning. And I thank God for my AA family, for my actual real family, and for the people I work with and the people in my life. You know, it's just amazing how we can handle situations that used to baffle us before. And I have had those experiences, and I only can tell you my experiences because I experience this. That's the truth for me. And the other truth is just winning over another alcoholic by trust. You know, you got to get to know them. And when you get to know them, that's when you know they build the trust. That's when I had my problem because I came in here, I didn't trust anybody, I didn't trust you as far as I can throw you, and I hated the women. Oh, that is a good one right there. When I first got sober, my sponsor says, I want you to go to this meeting in Oceanside, and it's a big women's meeting. And I said, oh, what are you asking me to do that for? And, you know, I look back at it, and I'm so grateful for this. And so I went to that meeting a couple of times. How did you like the meeting? It was okay. You see, but I was closed-minded still. I wasn't really open-minded. And then about the fifth time when I went to the meeting, they made an announcement from the podium. Hey, we're going to go have lunch over here. Everyone is invited. So I got in my car and I left like I always do. And I pulled up to a little market to get some groceries. And one of the ladies, she was pulling out of her car. And the restaurant was about two doors over. She goes, hey, are you coming to, you know, have lunch with us? I said, oh, no, I'm not going to go have lunch with you. You guys didn't invite me. True story. So you didn't invite me because that's just me. You know, I'm self-centered to the core. And then she says, well, I'm inviting you now. And she took me in. She plopped my happy butt in the middle of all those women that I looked at them, and they were so made up. They looked good. They had their makeup on, their hair teased to heaven, dresses and everything, high heels and jewelry. They looked sharp. And I thought, I got clothes like that in my closet, too. You know, true story. She plopped myself in the middle of all those women with 30, 40, 25 years of sobriety. And I'm like, oh, my God. And I'm sitting there like with that face, like neon sign, don't talk to me. And one of the ladies there, she just started talking. And before you know, I started talking to the other one. And then I started talking. And we were just having a blast. And we shut down the lunch place. I was the last one to leave. You know, we're always the last ones to leave. And I called up my sponsor. I said, hey, guess what? She goes, what? I go, this time I went to go have lunch with those ladies. And she says, really? And how did that go? I go, let me tell you, they changed. True story. They changed. She starts busting up on the phone. She goes, no, you changed. And that's what Alcoholics Anonymous does for us. We change. Thank you for letting me share.